copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Good morning, everyone. I will try as far as possible to follow the outline that you have in your folders, but not having the total gift of prophecy, sometimes I will have to deviate because the results don't always exactly match predictions. And you'll see the first heading in the outline is the European elections, why bother? So if you don't think they're worth bothering about, now's the time to leave. Turnout in European elections is traditionally lower than for national elections. And in the UK, it's even lower than the turnout for local council elections. And getting lower, I had originally written. Although one of the plus points from the elections that finished on Sunday is that the decline Europe-wide in turnout has been halted. And those of us who were watching Europarl TV on the night will have seen the rejoicing of certain political group leaders in the parliament. Isn't this great? We've won such a good campaign, we've stopped the turnout going down, it's actually going up again. What they were rejoicing about was 0.09% increase in the turnover. Often it is said the elections are pointless and not worth bothering about because this is not the choosing of a government at stake. And anyway, the European Parliament is only a talking shop with no real power. Such attitudes are outdated. They had substance back in the days before 1979 when direct elections to the European Parliament were first held. In the days before, it was just parliamentarians who were seconded from national parliaments who met together, and they were only consulted by the Council of Ministers, who could safely ignore it if it didn't suit their wishes. But in the period since 1979, there has been a one-way of process finally consolidated in the Lisbon Treaty of relative power flowing from the other EU institutions towards the directly elected European Parliament. So a brief skim through some of the important powers that the Parliament has. Appointment of the European Commissioners. Under the treaties, it's for the national government representatives to propose candidates for membership of the European Commission. But they have to face confirmation hearings before the relevant standing committees of the European Parliament before being confirmed or rejected en bloc by a plenary vote. And that is the theory, that the Parliament can only make a decision one way or the other on the whole raft of commissioners. But in practice, they can get choosy, and they did famously back in 2009 with Rocco Buttiglione. Sadly for us, as he was a very convinced promoter of Christian values, and he was basically hounded out of office before he'd even got it by a very strong lobby in the Parliament. And the Commission, the governments were told very clearly, if you force this to the vote, you will lose the whole slate. So at the last minute, the President of the Council withdrew the slate of candidates and rearranged it. The Lisbon Treaty, which came into force since the last elections of the European Parliament, states that the results of the European Parliament elections must be taken into account by the European Council, that's the Prime Ministers of the 28 states, when proposing a candidate to be the next President of the European Commission. The leading political groups in the Parliament have decided to select candidates for the post of Commission President and seek to promote the notion that a vote for their political group is a vote for their candidate. And that's what they were rejoicing about and giving the credit for this turnaround in the turnout. A series of live presidential-style debates between these candidates was held. But its popularity can perhaps be gauged from the fact that less than half of the stations belonging to the European Broadcasting Union actually included them in their schedules. The political groups also tried to organise whistle-stop campaigning tours around national capitals for their candidates. I don't know how many of your countries were visited by these supposed candidates for the presidency of the European Commission. But in a number of countries, the local party faithful told them bluntly, for goodness sake, don't send the candidate here. We'll only lose votes. You may not be surprised to learn that the government representatives in the European Council don't share the European Parliament's interpretation of the Lisbon Treaty in this matter. They certainly do not wish to be tied down to accepting the candidate of whichever group ends up being the largest one in the House. But they do realise they have to get the Parliament's endorsement for whatever they propose, like the slate of commissioners as a whole. For the President individually, they must be accepted in a confirmation vote by the House. All three main parties selected men from old northwestern Europe, two former Prime Ministers of Belgium and Luxembourg, and the current President of the European Parliament from Germany, who has no ministerial experience and has behaved in the most partisan and alienating way during his presidency, and is under investigation for abuse of office to use the Parliament staff resources to further his own election campaign. I think personally it is highly unlikely that any of them will eventually be offered the job. And certainly the UK government, and I hear as of last night three other governments, have made clear their opposition to the whole slate. The Council has it in its power to very simply scupper the game by these candidates' home countries merely failing to nominate them for membership of the Commission, but I think it will be more subtle. The failure of the group to which the British Conservatives belong and others to put forward a candidate gives them the freedom to negotiate with other groups to put forward a coalition suggestion. And there are eminently suitable characters from Eastern Europe and Scandinavia much more likely to secure the support of the European Council. I think it would be far too tempting, for instance, just the one for instance, for the Socialists, if Mrs. Thorning-Schmidt, currently Prime Minister of Denmark, and Neil Kinnock's daughter-in-law, for the Brits, were put forward, with the alternative that someone from another political group might be put forward if they were not prepared to ditch Martin Schulz. What's this space? Co-legislator with the Council of Ministers. The power of co-decision has become more and more the chosen method of deciding EU legislation over the years, culminating in the Lisbon Treaty, where its official name has been helpfully changed to the Ordinary Legislative Procedure. This means that a legislative text prepared by the European Commission has then to go to the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers for scrutiny, and seldom comes through unchanged. But as well as amending the law, and it's not uncommon for more than 1,000 amendments to be considered to a single text, both these legislative chambers of the EU have the ultimate power of veto, and scarcely a year goes by without one or more of the Commission's proposals biting the dust and never making it onto the statutes book. In the United Kingdom in particular, it's become a matter of hot debate as to how much of our national legislation actually stems from initial in principle decision in Brussels. This debate is mostly a dialogue of the deaf, as it's not based on any agreed prior definition of what constitutes a national law in the first place. Is it just statute law? Does it include the multitude of subsidiary regulations and statutory instruments which do not go through full parliamentary scrutiny? The higher the comparator, the lower the percentage you end up with, and vice versa. The official answer from the House of Commons Library is around 9%. But UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, of whom more later, clings tenaciously to a figure of 70 to 75%, which they attribute to the Commissioner from Luxembourg responsible for justice, Viviane Reding, despite numerous official clarifications by her staff and herself that the figure actually describes the proportion of EU laws which go through the co-decision procedure described above. But UKIP have still not been willing to let go of that figure. They do not like to be confused by the facts. I'm totally unbiased in this, you understand. I suspect the truth lies somewhere between the two extremes. In British national political culture, it's common to blame Europe for draconian laws of which the details are actually dreamt up by British civil servants, and also from time to time to take credit for a new law being a good idea by the government when it in fact originated in Brussels. The ratifier of international agreements. If the above description of the Parliament's power is not sufficient to convince you that casting a vote is a worthwhile exercise, you may ask also to consider the Parliament has to ratify international agreements entered into by the EU. These bind all member states, especially in the area of international trade. All international agreements on import tariffs, market access regulations, etc., have to be first scrutinised by the European Parliament. Currently, the hot potato is a proposed transatlantic trade and investment partnership deal with the USA. There's strong political concern in Europe which no doubt had an influence on voting patterns, that the high standards of environmental and safety control in Europe could be compromised in order to cut a deal, and also the sort of international corporate versus sovereign dispute resolution mechanism, which has seen states punished for democratic law changes in North America, could be introduced here. Civil liberties concerns have also been a strong driver of EU legislation on data protection. But Edward Snowden's revelations about the US NSA spying activities has raised it to fever pitch in some quarters. Shortly after 9/11, the European Commission struck a private deal with the White House about the sharing of passengers' private data on transatlantic flights. Neither the European Parliament nor the US Congress had been consulted. It was the European Parliament, through the European Court of Justice, which had the effective power to reverse the Commission's action and force a total redrafting of the agreement to introduce privacy safeguards. And, just as King Charles I found out in the English Civil War, ignoring Parliament is a costly affair, not least because they vote your budget. The European Parliament also holds the purse strings and has to approve EU expenditure proposals. The Lisbon Treaty provided for a speeded up process to get the budget approved. This has in fact has resulted in it taking longer and longer every year because there is a failure to reach an agreement within the shortened timetable. So the process has to start all over again. As often happens in the US Congress, the Parliament's powers over the budget give a neat backdoor way to influence policy through budget amendment rather than taking on the larger challenge of trying to pilot through a complete statute. As a lobbyist, I've seen changes in the funding arrangements for overseas aid and women's organisations changed through this device, as well as establishing the principle of a single European helpline number for trafficking victims. Sadly, the Commission's implementation competence can sometimes make this a Pyrrhic victory. What does it feel like on the inside of European elections? Selectorate versus electorate. The UK voting system gives the least power to the electorate, although that's actually 8 countries altogether that have what is known as a closed list system. This makes the position on the party list allocated to a candidate the deciding factor. And who chooses his or her position on the list? Not the electorate at large, but the selectorate of the party hierarchy. Campaigning is therefore a matter of trying to curry favour with and impress those whose decision-making power within his or her own party. Communication with the general public is an optional extra and only really has efficacy for one candidate on the list who is on the margin between being elected or not. So it's generally those that further down the list that have to make the effort. For all the others, it's a foregone conclusion. Many MEPs have testified to me that it is the campaigning for position before the election proper with the selectorate of the party hierarchy they find most taxing rather than the election campaign proper. And this is a particular issue for those who have a strong Christian conscience, who maybe have a party hierarchy who have other views. And there's been clean outs from time to time of those with too sensitive consciences. Whereas where you have an open list system, as in Scandinavia, Christian candidates have been able to overtake the position given them on the party list and get elected when the hierarchy didn't find them popular. But fortunately, most member states have an open list system, and that means the party bosses do not have the last say. Although rarely does the biblical maxim of the last becoming first and vice versa happen, but it's a commonplace for candidates who are too far down the list to have a realistic prospect of getting elected to get promoted by the voters into a winning position. Suspended animation. Technically, MEPs who are in place before the election do not lose their seats until the 30th of June. This means they need to try to maintain their office presence in Brussels and continue to deal with correspondence from constituents. But this becomes increasingly difficult as staff who see the strong probability that their employer will not be chosen again by the voters flee to more stable employment positions elsewhere. And newly elected colleagues from their party come to camp out in their office because they're not allocated their own room until July. This is how you find the new MEPs. But it's not just existing MEPs who find their limbo period taxing. Those newly elected and fired up with enthusiasm and buoyed up by popular support find that they're at the bottom of the pecking order in Brussels and experience something of the transition trauma of new boys at the beginning of the school year. The unseemly struggle for position, and it's going to be in spades worse than last time with the election results that we've had, I'll come on to in a minute. The county's barely over before the struggle for position must begin. A functioning parliament needs clearly defined parties and political groups with known loyalties, as well as office holders taking responsibility to chair committees and oversee the work of the House. But during June, that's starting on Monday, these are all in a state of flux. The usual channels just do not exist. The vicissitudes of the election results or developing dissatisfaction with old loyalties or attraction to new ones makes for maximum fluidity and uncertainty. Although the larger political groupings may seem to have the power of continuity, this can be a delusion. Witness the UK Conservatives' exit from the European People's Party group after the last election in 2009. For smaller groups, who had barely scraped together the necessary 25 MEPs from seven countries to form a recognised group in the previous parliament, the whole process has to start again. Previously established groups can end up splitting or disappearing altogether, whilst new formations come into being from the remnants of the old, or as a result of new parties getting representation in the House for the first time, and there's plenty of those this time round. And that has ongoing impact for my work as a lobbyist, because groups have the power to get amendments submitted, get text changed and so on, that individual MEPs just can't do on their own, unless you can go around and collect 70, 90 signatures, whatever it may be. So having a group that is a reliable source of support on our issues is very important, and those can come and go in a very short period of time. So we come to the election results. This is our second election during the economic crisis. The crisis and the response to it by the EU and member state governments was a dominant factor in deciding voting intentions back in 2009. In the immediate aftermath of the crisis, the predominant electoral reaction was one of shock. The bottom had fallen out of the economic world as the ordinary citizen knew it. Collapsing banks, a collapsing property market, and defaulting mortgages, rock-bottom interest rates for savers, all these led to a feeling of profound discomfort and uncertainty. In their shock, the electorate sought out what they thought was the safe and the familiar and the competent. Parties of the centre-right, traditionally associated with business and wealth creation, and financial and fiscal prudence. For the first time since direct elections to the European Parliament were first introduced, a near universal Europe-wide political trend could be discerned. In all but one member state, which was Greece, parties of the centre-left lost votes and seats, and parties of the centre-right gained them. This was in marked contrast to the reaction of voters on both sides of the Atlantic to the Great Depression of the 1920s, when citizens looked to the left for a better deal, and in Britain the Labour Party got its first taste of government. But 5 years on from 2009, the mood and the circumstances have profoundly changed. I would argue the electorate have moved on from shock, and that the predominant emotion is one of anger. Anger at those felt to have caused the crisis in the first place, and anger at the very unequal distribution of costs and benefits since. In Northern Europe, there's a strong apprehension that the bankers and the financial service sector generally got us into this crisis, but not only were they bailed out by a large sum of taxpayers' money, but those who work for them continue to be paid substantial bonuses in spite of their failures. The "we're all in it together" rhetoric just doesn't wash when the austerity cuts seem to be falling heaviest on the poor and the vulnerable, and the fat cats just keep getting fatter. As public expenditure is inevitably skewed towards services for the less well off, cutting the deficit so easily translates into less for the poor, especially where it's not balanced or accompanied by tax rises for the better off, so that they're seen to contribute to the common cause of balancing the budget. In much of southern Europe, there's also a strong resentment against the actions of the EU and the IMF elite and their unequal treatment of member states. There is seen to be one law for rich northern member states and another for smaller and poorer southern ones. The heavy-handed way in which those states receiving bailouts are being made to pay for their alleged financial misdeeds, especially Greece and Cyprus, and the reluctance of rich northern states to underwrite their financial credibility with the bond markets until a very late stage in the game. And so the results reflect the re-electoral mood. According to all the polls, this feeling of anger was expected to result in another but very different pan-European voting trend, with right-of-centre parties shrinking and left-of-centre parties ending up relatively larger. In fact, it's not worked out quite like that. That is the case in most states, but there are 9 country exceptions, surprisingly including France, where before the election everybody was predicting a socialist collapse with Hollande being so unpopular. But in France, Cyprus, the Czech Republic, Greece, Ireland, Latvia, Luxembourg, Malta, Slovakia and Slovenia, the trend has not gone that way, but everywhere else it has. But this situation is a byproduct rather than the main game, which is a flight from the centre towards the extremes of both left and right. And one figure to me stands out from that. I've made a comparison between the number of seats in the Parliament this time round and last time round, having discounted from the fact that the Parliament is smaller. And there, the centre-right, main centre-right party, the EPP, is losing 55 seats. It's gone down. But the main centre-left party, the Socialists and Democrats, is losing 1 seat. So it's relatively, it's improved its position, but not actually by improving its vote. The extremes on the right seem to be benefiting more. So centre-right parties are the more vulnerable to vote loss. The voters' anger seems to be directed at the centre parties in general, both of right and left, who seem to be becoming less and less differentiated and more considered to be guilty by association with what is seen as a detached and aloof political elite, which is running the show both at the European and national level. So the rise of nationalism, populism, Euroscepticism. In the UK Independence Party did top the polls, as predicted. In France, Marine Le Pen's National Front topped the polls. But in the Netherlands, Geert Wilders' party actually went down a few percentage points. Jobbik in Hungary did well again. And on the left, the Alternative for Deutschland, but also the Greek far-left party, Syriza, which got 26.6% of the vote, just slightly below UKIP's 26.77% and the Front National's 24.95%. Depending on the ultimate strength of this trend, it could make up for a very different European Parliament. And to give you an impression, I talked to you about the EPP losing 55 seats and the SD losing 1 seat. The non-ANSCRI, that's the non-aligned individuals who have to be formed into a group on their own behalf, and those who are in parties which are not yet represented in the Parliament, increasing by 73 seats. So depending on the strength of this trend, it could make for a very different European Parliament, hence a very different EU in the future. Up until now, the parliamentary authorities have been able to rely on a broad left-right consensus that the European project is a good thing, that negotiating law proposals with a willingness to give and take in order to reach a compromise is also a good idea. This consensus is most definitely not shared by the rising parties of both right, left and right extremes. They do not share the centre's commitment to promoting Parliament's reputation as an institution and oiling the wheels of legislative production rather than holding things up. But what does this all mean for Christian values? In my view, 2 trends are very likely, with a mixture of positives and negatives. Number one, a more adversarial legislative process will slow things down. The process of negotiating changes to Commission text put to the Parliament is likely to become more complicated, with less possibility to rely on the goodwill of a broad range of participants. Successes such as we've recently benefited from with the clinical trials regulation, the medical diagnostic devices regulation, but there were cases where we got very good positive changes in good bioethics directive, where ethical safeguards which had been left out in the Commission proposed text were put in at the insistence of Parliament and Council after negotiation. But there will also hopefully be less possibility for texts we are unhappy with to be stitched up in closed negotiations with the Council of Ministers under the, in my view, infamous first reading agreement procedure. Number two, an end to the left progressive consensus? Question mark, or maybe it shouldn't be a question mark now. In part because of better internal discipline, the broad left has won most votes on Christian values issues until very recently. The promotion of a right to abortion on demand, insistence on the redefinition of marriage for a diversity of family forms, reinterpretation of tolerance to become compulsory affirmation of alternative lifestyles. If this consensus is broken, does the push for social engineering stand still, or can the process of progressive change actually be reversed? These are good questions to be contemplating. The parties of left and right extremes are by and large less committed, or not committed at all, to the political correctness consensus around gay rights and reproductive rights, making it less likely the proposals in this field will prevail. But they're also likely to be less willing to back reforms in the area of migration and social and economic exclusion, or stronger measures towards achieving the Millennium Development Goals, which most Christians would see as a retrograde step. As in the case of national elections, the expected advance has actually happened, of the protest vote that is anticipated, is unlikely to be helpful in securing the timely taking of necessary but difficult decisions, which risk being unpopular in some quarters. And so to my conclusions. A number of countries, and not just the UK, are feeling a profound sense of dissatisfaction with the EU's performance in recent years. But elsewhere, the prevailing mood is for reform and better governance, not for abolition. The infamous democratic deficit and feelings of distance between the ruling elite and the electorate has, if anything, got wider since the last elections, even though the Parliament has been exercising its much wider powers given under the Lisbon Treaty for the first time during this period. All the signs are that the next Parliament is going to run less smoothly and with less predictable outcomes than the current one. If socially radical engineering proposals are put on the table, this may be no bad thing. But for the day-to-day delivery of improved conditions for those who live, work and travel in the EU, let alone the sorry tide of trafficked and asylum seekers, it is difficult to predict positive progress during the next 5 years. But in the longer run, if those in power can finally take heed of what the European man in the street is trying to say and reform the system so that it serves his needs and no longer gives primacy to vested interests and pet projects, we could see a revival of interest in and support for what the EU does and feel that we really are, and forgive this particular UK bit of humour, to coin a phrase, better together. Thank you. Couldn't I take some questions? I tried to be controversial there. Thank you, Julian. The question was that the rising number of members from parties of the extreme right and left may be helpful in terms of sorting the politically correct agenda, but some of these parties and some of these people are really rather unpleasant characters, and how will we as Christian lobbyists deal with this? I have to say I defer here to Paul, who's sitting in the audience, because he will be taking responsibility for this as I'm on my way out to retirement. It's a very difficult one. It's something I've already faced in the current Parliament, that there are people that other people feel are extremists, who actually have an unblemished record of voting in the right direction on our issues. And you just can't avoid meeting them and talking to them. But that can get you into trouble. I mean, I'll tell you, for an example, this is from a couple of parliaments ago. I used to meet regularly with Ian Paisley. And you can imagine that there were some, sorry, he's, for those who don't know, he's on the, what some would see as an extreme ring in Northern Ireland on the Protestant side of the argument of the unionism and republicanism. And there were those, particularly in the Labour Party, who said, what are you doing talking to this guy? You know, he's an extremist. But I had to live with that and I had to cope with that. What decision Paul will make on this, I don't know. The problem is that when you're trying to get support in the House, and a wide range of support on a particular issue, they're all sheep. They look to see who the leaders, what the leaders are doing, so they can follow them. And if you go along with the paper to get an MEP signature, and it's got before his one from one of these extreme parties, you can kiss goodbye to them signing it. You know, it's a very difficult area to cope with, and I don't have a straight answer. But the advice from organisations like yours will be very helpful. Next question. I'm being asked whether the Franco-German motor is broken, and how will the relationship with France and Germany, which has been at the heart of the European project from the beginning, how is that likely to develop in the coming years? It is very much an open question. Since the election of François Hollande, there has not been the same relationship between Berlin and Paris as there was before. Also, I mean, since the enlargement of the EU, it's not possible for France and Germany together to dictate ultimately to the rest of the community. Particularly with this rise of extremism in the popular vote in France, I think, please don't quote me, but I mean, very much François Hollande is going to be a bit of a lame duck from now on. And I can't see how there can be strong measures taken together between the French and Germans, even if they can agree during this period. We are going into uncharted territory, that would be my feeling. Making the comparison with the US, where there is a perception that Christians are all on one side of the political debate and only ever vote for the Republican Party, is there a role for Christians in the European Parliament, maybe to be something of a bridge builder, of a moderating influence, of something that can bring the different extreme sides together? On a personal level, this can work. I mean, certainly in Westminster, the way that the Houses of Parliament, Christian, various party Christian groups meet together, and one of the rare occasions for where MPs from across the political divide actually meet and talk to each other and have fellowship with each other, other than actually on a specific political issue. That certainly is something, but that's... But as far as the sort of political issues work is concerned, it varies very much from subject to subject. I mean, we do broker cross-party deals in areas like trafficking and prostitution policy and so on, gambling policy as well during the process of the last Parliament, and the couple of pieces of bioethics legislation I referred to, they were actually... they were as a Labour Member of Parliament who was a rapporteur for that, and we got cross-party agreement on those as well. So it can happen, but it's sort of issue by issue rather than the whole thing. Okay, Farika's question is that there is an independent Christian candidate who unfortunately didn't get elected in Romania. He's a very energetic Christian lawyer. He's supporting the family and all our Christian values, but he ran as an independent. When he comes to the European Parliament, should he stay independent or should he join with a group, and would that compromise his position? Well, if it's the person I'm thinking of, they are already associated with a European political party in terms of the European Christian Political Movement. And the European Christian Political Movement, in the last Parliament, and I'm pretty sure again in the next Parliament, will be joining with the ECR group in the Parliament, the European Conservatives and Reformists. They retain their own identity as a party, but they, for practical reasons, as there's not enough of them, they join together with that group in terms of their voting in Parliament. So far, they have not found that that compromises their witness. They are free to follow their conscience when it comes to votes. But I've just been told my time's up.
Okay. We're really thrilled that Florica shares this with us. She's a Member of Parliament in Romania, was part of this network a few years ago, and I know that it's a very, very busy time for Florica back in Romania at the moment, so we're really, really pleased that she's been able to give time to us today.
It's really an honour to be here, and a pleasure for me, although, you know, I have my heart, you know, divided and my mind, because I would really have to be home in Bucharest, where we make very important decisions for the future of our party and the nation. And also with all these changes, I understand again how flexible someone needs to be. This is not a problem for me, because in the last like 15 years or 25 years, God taught me to be flexible. I will have different presentations that they were before, because I think that I am a different person and a different politician. It will not be so academic level, but I will try to send out some messages and principles by presenting my life and my journey with God, and how God was there with me and for me and transformed my life. My sub-theme for the presentation is God is using ordinary people to make extraordinary things. I really believe this, and I am here as an example, because there are sometimes in our lives circumstances that either put us down forever, and we consider ourselves victims, and we try to live our life after those very difficult circumstances, or the circumstances just help us grow and go to the next stage if we believe in God. This is what I try to do, and you know, I even have examples to demonstrate this truth. Because we just heard in the morning and these days about Abraham. He was the childless father, and then he became the father of nations. The only thing that God wanted for him was faith. And what happened to him was a test of his faith. I see that in many lives, including mine, I had my time, my test of faith in life. And I think that I passed it, because then God really opened lots of doors for me and have my life settled for the next years. Look at Moses with faith in God. He didn't have anything special, but he had problems that made him not the right person. You know, from a human resources perspective, you wouldn't choose Moses to become the great leader. And he became the great leader. And then Joseph, you know, from a spoiled little child, a shepherd, and then how he became the vizier of Egypt next to the Pharaoh. Or Esther, she was just a little orphan, and then God honored her, and she became the queen who saved the Jews. She had her important role. I think that all these people, and David, of course, who became a king after being just a shepherd and a bold little boy, we see here that the recipe is faith in God, and when hard circumstances come, still believe in God and ask for His guidance. And this is all that God wants from us. My biggest accomplishment is my family. I'm a mother of four children, and I have lately 3.5 grandchildren. The fourth one will come in November or December. But let me show you how my professional life looks like. It is very interesting, and I was never bored in my profession and nor in my life, as you can see. I was a student, and for 8 years I worked as a mechanical engineer. And then valley, when I was unemployed in 91, was when all the industry in Romania started to collapse. But the problem was, so this is professional graph, but also speaks a little bit about my personal and family life. When I was unemployed, I became unemployed in March 91. In that summer, I got pregnant with our third child. And in September, I lost my husband in a car accident. He was a musician, a professor, choir director. And you can imagine what a terrible combination that was. That was for me the moment of testing my faith. I was a believer. I got baptized when I was 16. I sang in the choir. I was very much involved in the choir, in the church, behind my husband, supporting him, and doing what I could and raising our family. But God said, okay, enough. I have something else prepared for you. It was the deepest valley of my life, but it was the most wonderful time with God. And only people who went through suffering can understand these words, because they are real. It's not just, you know, to make you feel, I don't know, awkward. Because I only had God to rely on. As I said before, I was really relying on my husband, who was a personality, and just helping him, but not doing much. And I was a very shy person. I also had a very sad childhood with in my family. But God had something more in plan for me. Immediately after this shock, 3 days after, I received and I accepted, after some time of reflection, to change completely my career, and I became a recorder teacher, you know, the flute. It was surprising how God prepared me while I was a student at mechanics to learn how to play this instrument. And then it became my job and my way of getting a salary for the next 4 years. Then this ended, and I went into a new, completely new field, which was translation. That was the moment when my son, who was about 12, my oldest son, Philip, taught me how to use a computer for the first time in my life. I remarried 2 years after my first husband's death. I had the fourth child, and after being a translator for 4 years, having the child, I was again unemployed. It wasn't that deep valley, but it was, because I was 39 when I finished with this maternity leave that we have in Romania. And this is an age when in Romania you are considered quite old and you are not given too many chances to get a job. And I didn't know exactly what I could do. So I was trying hard to find something that was appropriate for me, because to be a wife and mother of four was not enough, and also involved in the church. The biggest challenge in this area, I think, was coming, and it was to become a founding member and executive director of Integra Romania Association, which it was for a while, it still exists, but changed a little bit the profile, a microfinance institution. So for 8 years, we had training in business, microloans, and consulting during the term of the loan. Also, through Integra, we tried to encourage women especially and families to start or expand a small business by giving them support, offering them a personal relationship to mentor them, to help them grow. And I used my personal story with all those women, and they were like 2,000 people in our training programs, to help them and encourage them and motivate them for the hard work. It was very interesting how God made this possible, because you can see all the training that I had before. It was nothing like that. And when I was told that I am supposed to teach business plans and put together a lending program, and I got the trust of some organizations, because we got a matching grant from USAID and the Christian American organization, and they were offering this almost $400,000 in my hands, trusting me that I will be able to do the job. It was a huge responsibility. I looked at me and I said, no way, I'm not able to do this. But then I realized that this is from God. And it was a very successful program with 99% of reimbursement rate. But the challenges kept coming into my life. And when we had a little bit of difficulties in the organization, because we gave up to the micro-lending because of the new legislation in Romania, and we were trying to find our new direction, I got an offer to become a city council member in Oradea, my city, because the mayor-to-be, who is now the mayor in his second mandate, wanted to renew the council members and have people with Christian principles, integrity in the council. It was the first time when our evangelical churches were addressed with something like this, and they were caught by surprise. They didn't know how to react to this, and they didn't have people prepared because they didn't know for what. I was very surprised, and I laughed when I heard that my very conservative Baptist church of 4,000 members will recommend me for this job. And I said, maybe, you know, I am that quantity that you can get rid of. If something happens, you know, it's not a big loss for the church. Anyway, I didn't want to go into politics. I never wanted that. I thought that politics is for I don't know whom, but not for me. But I was so involved in community development, and I took it as another platform to influence the community and do good things for the people. This was my motivation to enter the politics. And I remember the mayor who told me, you cannot be an independent in the city council. I mean, you can, theoretically, but you don't have the financial capacity, and also you need support in order to do anything. I invite you in my party, which is not the best because there is no ideal party. They are all formed by people, and there are good people and bad people. But I believe in it, and it's really a good party, the only historical party in Romania. And then the next challenge came to become member of parliament in December 2012. I became a member of parliament, and this is the first time when my full life is dedicated to politics, and my salary is paid out of speaking and making laws and meeting people, because to be in a city council is just, you know, like a voluntary, and you get a stipend for the expenses. So it was very interesting how I got there. You know, I found this very nice quote: when you doubt your power, you give power to your doubt. Each time when I said no, this was my first reaction to anything that was offered to me. I looked first at myself, and I saw myself as not being ready for the challenge and not being prepared. Lord, I don't have the skills, I don't have the experience, I don't have the money, I don't have the background for doing this. But when I realized that there are so many people who see something in me that I cannot see, I realized that this is from God, and I said, okay, God, I will go just because you want it, but you must be there for me. It's your job, not mine. Mine is just to be the voice and, you know, you can use my human being, but you have to give me the wisdom and help me in this new challenge. I put some pictures because we like pictures, especially the women. you know, to see the variety of the activities. I am, and I always was, with people. In the city council, I was the president of the social committee, and we had lots of things here, very, very nice. I was a deputy mayor for half an year before going to the parliament, and being an official for marrying people to running on the streets and all kind of official things. And then this is from the campaign. I was all over, so everybody now know my name. In the city, when I go to the market, they all call me, hello, Miss Florica, how are you doing? And now I'm in the parliament with still the same activities, many, many activities for the community and for the people. My areas of interest are family, education, youth, and Christian involvement in the community life and politics. And my main activities and objectives are, so what is a politician like me doing? Legislation, all kind of events, especially in Oradea, sharing my life and God's love at any time, because some of the people are surprised to think or see or hear that as being a member of parliament, I have so many opportunities to speak about God. And I use my personal story many times just to open the door for God, but also to show principles and to show that not all the politicians are, you know, people to blame. You have to take the good things that lie in the people. Of course, that in some people it's very hard to find the good things, but still, I'm sure that they are, because they are made by God. Also, it's very important for me to influence the church leaders and the young generation, so I respond to invitations to speak to young people, motivate them, boys and girls, to do something, and also the church leaders. Now, of course, that in my culture, it's quite hard. I am a woman. How can I go to, you know, the leaders of a church? Of course, they are all men. And tell them what to do, what to say, how to encourage their people. It's very, very hard. But I have to do it because I understand how important it is for them to ask their members to be involved in the community life, in all kind of projects, to be involved in businesses, in politics. I ask people to send and to go into different parties. I don't mind if they go in that party, in that party, at least we'll have collaborators in all the parties. Some people feel, oh no, I will get dirty in my hands, I will compromise. Of course that you ruin your reputation next day when you go into politics, but you have to take the risk, because if you feel that this is God's call for you, you have to go. What can I say, you know? I mean, I said, oh no, I will not go. And then I thought, so this is such an honor. There are so many people who fight for this, compromise for this, pay big bribes for this. And I say, no, I don't want to be member of parliament. And this is what I did until I realized that it was a big mistake. And also be an honorable representative of Romania wherever God takes me, including this one and others. I went to different national prayer breakfasts because I am a member of the prayer group that meets every Tuesday in our Romanian parliament. In terms of legislation, I was involved in making changes to the law of education especially regarding preschool, secondary school and professional training, because this is very, very needed now in Romania and in the European countries. We have too many young people that have lots of university diplomas, no job, but lots of, things that they demand for themselves just because they are graduates. And of course that it's very offending when you tell them that you should go and find a job in this company because they are looking for skilled workers. Also, amendment on the Constitution regarding the definition of family. I sent an amendment because Romania is in the process of revising its constitution. Last year, my biggest joy was to see that it was adopted, and a week after, the vote was taken again based on some pressure that came from the president of Romania, prime minister, and other all kind of NGOs, and it was rejected. The only article that was voted twice. And now God brought another opportunity that not many people knew about, but I heard, and I put again the amendment, so they have to take the vote again. And now I try to speak to as many people as possible from my country especially. I need support. I am in the politics. I am only one. I need the other Romanians who believe in God and want to fight for the families in Romania to come along and help with whatever they can. Law of adoption also, because we need to accelerate the process of adoption in Romania. Counseling before abortion, this is a big theme, and lots of people will be very upset that I come with such a stupid thing for some. Okay, what does it take to be in the politics? Faith in God, I think it's the first thing. Flexibility and adaptability to new things, new circumstances. Proactive attitude and civic spirit. Accept new beginnings. You need to be very open-minded because not always things are as you wish they are. And you are not speaking with nice people in the church, with people who share the same values, but you have to find some common things that you can build something together. People in my party, people in other parties. It doesn't matter what party they belong to. We have to find bridges and work something together. Also, you need continuous learning because everything changes and you need to learn a lot of things. And permanent contact with others who can encourage and help. I appreciate so much when I get a text message with a verse from the Bible or a telephone or something. It's really helping me a lot. My recipes for success in general is trust God, trust yourself, and work hard. Because I think that these three ingredients are essential for the growth of a person. And I don't know how. There are people who advance in their career without trusting God, but trusting themselves. But this is, you know, for an earthly position. I am not interested in earthly positions. And this is why I don't know. I don't have any objectives. I am just there, available for God to use me. This is the end of my presentation, and I wanted to talk about these things because you can see there are very few people in politics and who are working and getting their salary out of politics. But you are here leaders and people with a lot of knowledge and information, and you can support the politicians because, you know, out of a population of 20 million, there are 500 and so people in the parliament. I was in the city council, 200,000 people in Oradea, 27 in the city council. So there are few people who go there, but they don't need to be left alone there. Because, you know, I try to work with people so they will understand. For instance, Roxana at Provita, she will support my work. I will support her work and will support our countries because we need to make good laws for our countries. We need to make changes. I am not that smart to know all the changes that need to be made in laws. But I always say to the experts in their fields, you know exactly the article and the law that need to be changed to be better in your situation. Please explain to me, make me understand. And if I understand, I will be able to go and lobby for it and make it an initiative, a legislative initiative. But we need to learn to work together. For many people, this is something new and it's not usual and they don't understand it. But hopefully in the last months, I started to get help and support and also partners in my work. So thank you very much